question, isn't it? Can we make sense of suffering? I recently came across this old fable. It was written in some ancient time. It was a king out east. That's where fables always happen, isn't it? Out east, a king instructed his wise men, gathered them together, and he said, I need some words. I need you, wise men, to find some words for me. Some words that are going to be good in good times, but particularly words that are going to be good and useful and make sense through bad times, through times of suffering. I need words to make sense of these times. And the wise men went away and they scratched their heads and they came back and presented their wise words to the king after some time. This is what they said. And this too shall pass. Very simple. And this too shall pass. And I guess in terms of wise words, it pretty much works, doesn't it? The assumption being that suffering is eased by the passage of time. We have in Borough some neighbors. Actually, they've moved now, but for many years they lived next to us. They were from Miami, and I think they found the weather here rather oppressive. They lived next to us for about 10 years, and they had on their in their living room, you could see it as you walked past their front window, a poster which basically captured this fable, and it said very simply, "Mist will pass." And I think that's the way a lot of people live life, isn't it? One day, this will all sort of pass, and we can bear what's going on. And outside of Christianity, I am not aware of a better alternative. One day, the suffering you experience will pass. That's what the world says. And as a Christian, I want to say a couple of things to that. First, I realize for many that that is really the best that you've ever come across and the best and only way that you know how to live. And it's compounded, of course, isn't it? Every time we watch a sort of a film, Hollywood sort of platitude, don't worry, everything will be all right in the end. You hear that in most films that have any type of suffering or disaster in them. But of course, as we look in on that, we know that that sort of blind, groundless hope isn't comforting in the end. So that's the first thing I want to say to this sort of worldview. Secondly, whilst Christians, we can't promise to take suffering away in this life. We can offer some explanation as to why it exists. And perhaps more importantly for our subject today, we can offer hope in the face of suffering. And by that, what I'm going to explain, a certain grounded hope. A certain grounded hope. A life in the future where suffering will not exist. That's not a platitude, that's a reality. And that makes sense of the here and now. That's what I want to explain. How do we explain that as Christians? Well, we have to sort of go to some sort of authority. We can't just kind of give you words out of our heads, not if we expect people to take us seriously today. I'd suggest that the best way of making sense of important questions like this is to look to Jesus. Why? Well, because Jesus claimed to be God. He spoke with his authority, and he acted with his power. And so I'm going to be referring, as we go, to a few verses from Matthew's gospel. And we'll be going through a story. It's quite an exciting story, and various things happen along the way. And we'll be reading it as we go. So you may want to turn to that. Tom, can you just tell me where Matthew chapter 8? I forgot to make a note of the page. But do you turn to Matthew chapter 8?
813.
Page 813. Now, Matthew is, was a friend, disciple of Jesus. He also used to be a tax accountant. But don't let that put you off, okay? The fact that he's a tax accountant, he's actually a really interesting writer. So they don't always go together, but they do in this case. So here we go. We're going to dive in, and we catch up with Jesus just after, I guess, the most famous sermon ever given, the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus sort of finishes that sermon. He steps off the mountain, and he steps, my first point there, into a world of suffering. And I'm going to read from 8, verse 1. When Jesus came down from the mountain, great crowds followed him. And behold, a leper came to him and knelt before him, saying, "Lord, if you will, you can make me clean." Now, leprosy is a horrible illness, isn't it? I don't know if you know much about it. I did a little bit of research. Definitely don't click images. You don't want to see what leprosy looks like. But in 1995, those were the most recent stats I could find in terms of its sort of prevalence in our world today. The WHO, World Health Organization, they estimated that between 2 and 3 million people in our world were permanently disabled just because of this disease. Well, in Jesus' day, it was even worse. I mean, people were excluded from society. Everyone had to self-isolate. Back then, they had little choice. It was a miserable, painful existence. Let's carry on in the story. Jesus then meets a centurion, verse 6, came running up to Jesus. 8, verse 6, Lord, my servant is lying paralyzed at home, suffering terribly. Now, the centurion, interesting man. He was a man who had risen to the ranks. He got things done. He solved problems. You don't end up being a centurion in charge of 100 men in the Roman forces unless you were good at getting things done. But this situation was different. He was confronted with a problem he couldn't solve. Now, if you're anything like me, I love solving problems, and I get distracted when there's a problem because I want to go and sort of do it. It's so frustrating, though, isn't it, when the problem that's before us lies outside our power and control to solve. It's so, so humiliating. And so often we're left like the centurion, just desperate. Let's read on, just sort of an overview. We'll come back and look at some of the detail in a few minutes. Verse 14, we read, when Jesus entered Peter's house, he saw his mother-in-law lying sick with a fever. Now, Peter was another one of the disciples, and he went in and saw this sick lady. We don't know what caused the fever. Lots of things then and now would have caused fevers. Today, the most common cause of a fever is malaria. More recent stats here, 2021, WHO again, 241 million clinical cases of malaria. And that sort of figure gets reported every year. You know, a child dies every 2 minutes from malaria. It's a tragedy. That's our world today. Suffering of Jesus' day, the suffering of our day. Well, it's something we can relate to, of course. And perhaps just to make the point, look down at verse 16 in our reading. Verse 16 tells us, many who were demon-possessed, sick, brought to Jesus. Here is Jesus. He steps into this world of suffering. And it's a miserable world, physical and mental and social and spiritual suffering. All around Jesus. Now, the presence of suffering is enough to make many question the existence of a good and powerful God. It's worth just pausing at this moment and asking, well, how do other worldviews actually deal with this question? Again, as Christians, as I've already said, we don't have all the answers, but we are in a better position than, let's say, the atheist. I mean, So hopeless, I'd like to suggest, if all that can be concluded is that we're a bag of chemicals following a natural evolutionary trajectory. How hopeless. Tchaikovsky captured this. I was having some debate with Rachel, who's one of our music sort of maestros, about this. She reckons it's Beethoven. I reckon she's probably right. So I think the quote is probably wrong. I reckon it's Beethoven. Apparently in his Fifth Symphony, it's that really sort of ominous one. And Beethoven's own testimony about that symphony was that those sort of repeated refrains that you hear again and again, they're there to remind us about total submission before fate. Every time you hear that repeated refrain, remember, says Beethoven, that it's all about the fact that fate will get you. Fate will get you in the end. I mean, how horrible to live in that sort of shadow. A friend of mine told me the story of a few years ago. He'd been called out in the middle of the night, and he'd been called to a neighbor. His friend was a vicar. His neighbor was an atheist. And he was in hospital. This neighbor was crying beside the bedside of his wife. His wife had just died of a horrible illness. And this neighbor, scientist and atheist, just sat there crying. And my friend sat with him. And after a few minutes, the neighbor looked up and said this. He said, when it's test tubes in the lab, atheism's fine. But when it's your own wife, it just won't do. See, our suffering world shows us. Our suffering world shows us very simply, this world is not right. And personally, that feeling of sort of helplessness as we observe the ongoing human cost. I mean, it's such a tragedy, isn't it? The stuff that's been going on in our world. You think about the misery caused through lockdowns. You think about the war raging on in Ukraine right now. It's just horrible, some of the war crimes that are being reported. And combine all of that with injustice and heartache, it's enough to make anyone say, what a messed up world. I wonder if it ever occurred to you, though, that God may be interested in something more important than than our comfort? We may think, it's sort of a natural sort of human tendency to think that peace and prosperity and happiness are, they must be what God wants for us right now. But the Christian believes that humanity threw the possibility of a suffering-free world away. And that happened collectively when we pushed God out of our lives. We can all testify to that individual choice of pushing God out of our lives. And of course, humanity as a whole has done exactly that. Now, you may be quick to point out, of course, there's lots of suffering in this world that is caused by humanity's pride. Again, look at the Russians, great example of that. Russian aggression against the Ukrainians proves the point. But the Bible's answer to the question of what caused the suffering in the world goes deeper still. It can't just be pointed at some people. All of us, corporately, we did. You see, we would rather run our world without reference to him. We'd rather go it alone. And now in our world today, God will sometimes use our suffering to bring us to our senses. God is interested in something more than our short-term happiness. And he'll use suffering to bring us to our senses, to wake us up to the problem. Like my atheist friend who just complained as he understandably poured out tears over his dead wife. It just won't do. This just doesn't make sense. C.S. Lewis, the writer of the Narnia books, he famously said, "Suffering is God's megaphone to rouse a deaf world." The world today, the world in Jesus' time, it's so obviously broken, it's so obviously not right. The natural, the only response, help. I can't cope. We just can't deal with this. And so secondly, look at Jesus, look at the hope that he provides. The hope that he provides in the face of suffering. I love the way that Jesus deals with suffering. It's so wonderful. It's so refreshing. So clearly God's authority. We'll just go back through some of those incidents of suffering that we looked at in Matthew 8, and we'll see what Jesus did. You remember the first character that came up to Jesus? Verse 3, have a look back. The leper came bounding up, asked to be made clean. And what did Jesus do? Verse 3, Jesus stretched out his hand, touched the leper, saying, "I will be clean." Immediately, his leprosy was cleansed. In Jesus' day, people wouldn't touch a leper. They believed that leprosy was contagious. But without hesitation, here is Jesus touching the leper, healing the leper, instantaneous, complete. Peter's mother-in-law, have a look at that one. Peter's mother-in-law, verse 15, touched her hand. The fever left her. Did it heal her properly, this miraculous touch? She rose and began to serve. Complete. You don't start sort of boiling rice if you're not completely well again. That's the point. And you might say, I mean, the fact that Peter didn't turn his back even after his mother-in-law was healed. Well, at least two miracles took place that day. And as you go back through the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they're full of similar accounts, stories of Jesus providing hope in the face of suffering. I skipped over the one of the centurion. Look back at verse 6. The centurion says to Jesus, "Lord, my servant is lying paralyzed at home, suffering terribly." And Jesus said to him, "I will come and heal him." But the centurion replied, "Lord, I am not worthy to have you come under my roof, but only say the word, my servant will be healed. For I too am a man under authority with soldiers under me. And I say to one, go, and he goes, and another, come, and he comes. And to my servant, do this, and he does it." Now, the centurion takes hope in Jesus to the next level. He knows. He knows perfectly well. He doesn't need Jesus to come and stand geographically in his presence and actually touch his servant. All he needs to do is say the word. And the logic goes like this. Here's the centurion, the soldier, speaking to Jesus, and he's saying, "Look, I understand, Jesus, the chain of command. I'm going to show you I understand the chain of command by asking you to do something." Chain of command works very simply. When the emperor makes some sort of edict, it's given to my superiors. My superiors will give it to me. I give it to the soldier acts. In other words, when the emperor speaks, the soldier acts. That's the chain of command. That's how it happens. It's as though the centurion is therefore saying, "Jesus, I understand your word carries God's authority. When you speak, it's as though God speaks. It is God speaking. So Jesus, give the word. That's all I need. Give the word. Jesus is amazed, verse 10. When Jesus heard this, he marveled and said to those who followed him, "Truly, I tell you, with no one in Israel have I found such faith." And then look at the conclusion, verse 13. Jesus gave the word, "Go, let it be done for you as you have believed." The servant was healed at that very moment. And so this leads us really to the main application, the main outbox, if you like, of what it looks like for us to have hope in the face of suffering. The centurion is a great example. He took Jesus at his word. That's ultimately what faith is, putting our trust in Jesus, putting our trust in what Jesus says. Let me try and illustrate this, to try and make this as straightforward as possible. It's a true story. In the 19th century, there was a man named Charles Blondin, quite an eccentric guy from what I can make out. And he made a name for himself as a tightrope walker. And he did lots of crazy stunts on very high ropes. And he became famous for crossing Niagara Falls on a tightrope. And he became more famous when he brought sort of props. He brought a wheelbarrow and pushed that across the tightrope. And he brought a big ladder and carried that across. And he even carried a working oven across Niagara Falls. He was eccentric, he was French, and he crossed Niagara Falls. Well, one day he gathered a crowd and he didn't have any particular tricks up his sleeve that day, no working ovens or anything, so he decided to turn around to the crowd and say, "Anyone want to come with me?" And a young man volunteered and jumped on his back. And so Blondin sort of made his way across the rope, across Niagara Falls. Halfway across, there were some unexpected gusts of wind, and the whole rope sort of wobbled, as you'd expect. And the guy on the Blondin's back freaked out and just said, "Get me out of here." And Blondin apparently had to turn to him and very firmly just say, "Just trust me. I'll get us through. I'll take us to the other side. I'll bring us safely through. Just trust me." And I guess there's a good picture of what faith in Jesus, to take him at his word, actually looks like. It's not a platitude. It's a promise of substance. You see, Jesus will take us through. And that means someone with us during times of suffering. And it means, of course, that there is somewhere worth going, the other side of suffering. Back to the people in Jesus' day. I mean, this was a unique time. God visibly demonstrating his care, his authority through Jesus, through his son. So it's as if to sort of underline the points already made. Jesus carries on healing the sick well into the night. Look at verse 16. Again, they brought, that evening they brought to him many who were oppressed by demons, and he cast out the spirits with a word, healed all who were sick. So what does it mean for us today to have a hope in Jesus? Will he take away my suffering today? I hope it's clear, no. There are some brands of Christianity that will suggest that or even offer that. As I've already said, though, this is a unique period in history, and Jesus made it absolutely clear to follow him will not be an end of suffering now. What Jesus promises is that those who trust him will make it through times of suffering to the other side. Because, this brings us to the third and final point, Jesus provides an end to suffering. I mean, it'd be wonderful if I could stand here today and just say, "Look, guys, this is your lucky day. If you're invited along, if you're listening online, this is your lucky day. All you've got to do is say this magic incantation, spin around a few times, promise to lead a good life, of course, and all your suffering will go away." But we need to remember, I mean, even in Jesus' day, these miraculous healings, I mean, the centurion's servant, Peter's mother-in-law, the leper, they went on to die. It's not like they were excluded from other suffering in the world. They probably, and we don't have details, they probably went on to suffer again as well. But the last verse of our passage that we haven't read yet, where our reading ends, verse 17, it changes everything. Look at this verse. This is worth just sort of really absorbing. Immediately after Jesus had healed all these people, look at verse 17. This was to fulfill what was spoken by the prophet Isaiah. He took our illnesses and bore our diseases. Now, Jesus is here well, it's Matthew in the first instance, isn't it? He's reporting a quote from the Old Testament, from one of the most famous chapters in the whole Old Testament, Isaiah 53. This was written 700 years before Jesus burst onto the scene. It's worth seeing yourself. So just flick back. I think you'll find it page 613. Bottom of 613, beginning of 614, I think. You see, it's worth pointing out that when the New Testament quotes an Old Testament verse, there's an expectation that we understand the context of that verse. Now, this prophecy states that one day a servant would come. One day in the future, Isaiah says, a servant would come and die a terrible death to deal with not just suffering, but the root cause of suffering. So have a look. We'll read from Isaiah 53. I'll begin at verse 3 and I'll read through to verse 6. He, that's the servant, reference to Jesus, was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief, and as one from whom men hid their faces, he was despised and we esteemed him not. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. That's the quote from Matthew. Yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace. And with his stripes we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned each one to his own way. And the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. Now the prophecy looked forward to a time when Jesus would go to the cross. And Jesus would carry to the cross. Here's the sort of the logic to follow through. Jesus would carry to the cross the sin of his people. I guess that's a pretty well-known fact, isn't it? And that's even if you're sort of looking into things, you probably heard that idea before, that Jesus carries the sin of his people to the cross. Less well-known is this other fact that Isaiah draws our attention to, that Jesus carried to the cross also the suffering of his people. Look at verse 4 again in Isaiah 53. Just at the top of page 614. Verse 4, surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Now, flick back to Matthew chapter 8, page 813. You'll see there the quote from verse 17, he took our illnesses, bore our diseases. Now, clearly this is Matthew's own translation of the Hebrew here, but the meaning is exactly the same. Jesus dealt with our suffering, our illnesses, our diseases, by going to the cross. This is quite a big idea, quite a profound idea. Jesus dealt with our suffering by going to the cross. What that means, of course, is that the only way he could deal with illnesses and suffering, the only way he could go around healing people, was because he was inevitably going to the cross. And so his healing ministry is dependent on his upcoming work on the cross. This means, of course, the cross deals not just with sin, but with suffering too. They're joined together. I'm going to try and illustrate this because I think whilst it's a straightforward idea, the implications are profound. So here we go. High-tech illustration here. Sin. Okay, this is our rejection of God when we push God out of our life. Something we're aware of individually, something that humanity has done corporately, sin. Here is suffering. Suffering that, again, doesn't need any explanation. We've gone into that. Now, what it means, of course, is that sin and suffering are inextricably bound together. Sin and suffering belong together, and Jesus carried both to the cross. So here is Jesus, and the sin and suffering of his people was laid on him. What happened? Well, it hasn't happened yet in Matthew 8, but as you read on in Matthew, what happens, of course, is Jesus goes to the cross and takes the sin and the suffering of his people to the cross. He dies. And that means this is taken to the grave and dealt with. And how do we know it was dealt with? Because Jesus rose, as we're about to celebrate a week today, Easter Sunday. Sin and suffering dealt with. What that means, of course, is that the cross uniquely opens up a door, an existence without suffering. But you see, you can't separate the two. You can't separate sin and suffering. They're bound together, which means to have our suffering problem dealt with, we have to have our sin problem dealt with. You can't have one without the other. In Jesus' day, he gave us a glimpse of that suffering-free future reality, like a movie trailer for a life that hasn't yet begun. It's wonderful, isn't it? Everywhere he goes, he touches people, he heals people with a word, sometimes just with a glance. Jesus puts things right. Here is a picture of the life that is possible one day for Christians. In our day, well, we will still suffer, just like we will still sin. But one day in the world to come, a world of no suffering. And so I guess the question as we close is, how do we access that? There's only one way, and that is faith. Faith, the centurion is the perfect example. He knew Jesus could be trusted. He knew that his word counted. And that's the heart of the Christian faith. On the cross, the sin of his people, the suffering of his people, mine and yours if you believe, laid on Jesus. He died that Good Friday, the first Good Friday, to take it to the grave. He rose that first Easter Sunday to prove he'd finished the job. That opens up the doors of heaven. And so the end of suffering is guaranteed, a future reality for all who become Christians. Now, you may be listening today and just thinking, actually, that this sounds interesting enough to want to take this further. Tom will explain a few ways we can do that afterwards. But why don't you speak to the person that invited you and ask them how they became a Christian? How do we make sense of suffering? It's a really important question. And can I just say, I don't know how people who aren't Christians really deal with things at the end of the day. We were watching this film as a family the other day, and I can't remember what it was. It was nothing particularly remarkable, but it was there were a couple of gangs at one point who were shooting at each other, and a stray bullet killed one of the sort of main characters, a little child, tiny little child. And it was completely devastating. It sort of happened out of nowhere. None of us were expecting it. And, you know, stupid little film, but the best the film could do is sort of as they gather together and sort of some baseball team playing, and they said, oh, well, little boy's looking down at us from the sky, smiling now. It's just so pathetic. There's just nothing, no hope. That is not the sort of life that God needs us to leave. There is hope as we look at Jesus. A relationship with Jesus can start today. Jesus will get you through. He doesn't leave you, abandon you. But one day, a perfect, pain-free life. Guaranteed, grounded hope because of the cross. A few things to think about. A few questions down at the bottom there you may want to discuss with each other at the end of our time together. But I'm going to hand back to Tom now. Finish off our time.